Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. Welcome to the Talky Bit. This is a continuation of part four. I've had some correspondence recently with someone who has started to be kind of reeled in by AI in the fishing rod sense of reeled in. And this is somebody that I've known for a long time, for decades, and that I've corresponded with for much of that time. And so I've corresponded with them enough to know how they sound when they communicate in writing. I can hear their voice in writing, like their syntax, their style, if you want to use that. It's kind of a formal word. But the way they sound in writing is very familiar to me. So when I got an email from them recently that didn't feel right, it's highly subjective, I know. It got me thinking about some of the other things that they'd said recently to me that they'd been experiencing, and it sort of started to make sense. Now, I don't mean anything unkind here. AI improved their spelling, their grammar, and their sentence structure. The autocorrect software that's running in the background of my word processor does the same thing for me. But in this case, it also kind of felt like it stripped out their personality, because much of their personality shows up in their writing in ways that the bot would identify as mistakes. And that got me thinking about how we're surrounded by, how we're immersed in these structures that tell us what the right way is in all kinds of categories. Like, we're swimming in it, right? Many, perhaps even most of them, are so common, they're so ordinary that we don't even notice them. We might, if we're thinking about them at all, we might just say that's their culture. They're the water we're swimming in. And many of them we've grown up with, and that makes it even harder for us to see them from any outside vantage point. Perhaps given that we're here to explore what we believe, it shouldn't come as any kind of surprise for me to point out that some of those structures are about sort of our formal beliefs. They're the kind of structures that tell us what constitutes right belief in a way that's analogous to the bot saying, this is right grammar. As most of you know, because I can't seem to keep it to myself, one of my adult kids is a writer. That's what they do. And because they write fiction and because they're writing for established publishers, they would say that before one of their books shows up on the shelf, it's been through probably 6 to 8 sets of editorial eyes. And because they're writing YA, and because the two current novels are YA horror to boot, and because of their personal style, they do things deliberately. Their grammar is fantastic. They do things that break the rules. And they have to put a marginal note with those, of course, because otherwise they'll send it to the editor and the editor will fix it or tell them to fix it, right? And they're like, nope, this is on purpose. And they have I can't remember what the acronym is, but there's an acronym that says, I meant to do this. So their editor knows what's going on. So this stuff just exists all around us. It can be hard to know when we encounter those things that tell us what right is. I mean, when Kale's writing and they encounter a grammatic or sentence structure thing that's right and they're doing it wrong, they're like, I know the rules and I'm breaking them on purpose. So what they feel is empowered. But we might have really different experiences than that when we encounter something about rightness and the rightness stops working for us. When we're told this is the right way to believe, this is the right way to do something, and we're like, nope, that's not right for me. That's not even okay for me. That might be harmful for me. And so we have all these feelings when we have those experiences, and they made quite a range, sort of from disquiet and despair on the unpleasant side to nervousness to exhilaration or something more over on the energized continuum, and everything in between and lots of others, right? We can have really strong feelings about this stuff. And yet, that sort of exploring is what we're here to do. It's what I'm personally trying to facilitate and support with every talk you bet, one way or another. I'm sure sometimes that seems a little oblique. Why am I so committed to that personally? Well, the simplest way I know how to say it is that millions of people are exploring what they believe. And for lots of them, the cost of that exploring is considerable. It has lots of shapes, but common ones would be the loss of community, the loss of connection with other people, or interference in those things, disruption in those things. And it's not necessarily generative disruption. It's just hard. And lots of those millions of people are doing this difficult thing alone. And there are some that choose that path. That's a preference. But for many, it's not. It's circumstantial. It's not what they prefer. And for those folks, it seems to me that there should be somewhere to work out a transition of this kind of complexity and magnitude in the company of others, which is where the table comes into play. So here we go, exploring together. First of all, what I want to do, because this series is by virtue of both its topic and my approach to the topic, it's information heavy in many ways. So I want to give us a quick summary of last week's exploration of toxic belief systems. I won't spend a lot of time on this. But in light of what I just said, I think it's worth noting, reminding us if we've been following, that each of these points is meant to encourage us to develop our awareness of belief systems that do three things. They diminish agency, they distort humanity, and they rely on fear. That's been our working definition for belief systems that potentially cause harm. And each of the points that I'm going to summarize here are basically here to encourage us to step back far enough to evaluate whatever system we're evaluating from a freer perspective. I'm not going to use binary language for that. I'm not going to say a free perspective or an unfree perspective. Those notions are way too complicated to leave them in a place that's that cursory. But to these points, we said last week in particular, and this was sort of a divergence from the religious trauma part of the conversation, a little bit of a, I called them resting strokes, which they may or may not feel like, but that was my analogy. The first of those was that toxic religious systems are rooted in fear. And we've named some of those particular doctrines that tend to produce that kind of an environment: fear of hell, divine punishment, rejection, losing God's favor. Often in toxic communities, those doctrines, those ideas function as psychological control mechanisms. They don't get called that in that context, but that's the way they're behaving. We also noted that fear-based systems produce compliance. They don't produce liberation. And also that compliance can feel like freedom when we're inside the system because we get rewarded for it, right? Feels good. You're doing the right thing. Couldn't do a better thing. Yes, it's hard. Carry on. And so on, right? We can feel like, yay. You know, we have all those good feelings. Second thing that we talked about is that claims of innate spiritual authority are actually institutional constructs. And we talked in particular about religious terms like pastor, priest, apostle, language of calling, language of anointing, and the notion that we're invited to consider the possibility that those don't carry any inherent divine authority. And they function inside of systems more like institutional branding. They're a way of identifying things positionally. But they're not ultimate. They're structural. And their power dissolves when we examine them from outside that framework. And in fact, if those frameworks become disaffected ones for us, it can be incredibly complicated. In my role here at the table, some people sometimes refer to me as pastor. But I don't think of myself that way at all. Not because I think being a pastor is a bad thing, because I don't think that's a good name for dysfunction in this community. And also there are things about that I've experienced that are abhorrent to me. So I have personal complexity around that, right? But when somebody uses that phrase and they're using it in a caring, respectful way, I don't have to take that on. I can receive that in the spirit it's offered, right? But there's complexity around those things. And that's because they're structural, and because in my experience, I'm now seeing them from outside of the framework. That person might not be, right? That's still the frame that works for them. So we talked about that. Sacredness, we also talked about, is socially constructed, also not objectively inherent. What communities call sacred or holy, we use the illustration of the objects on our table here. What communities call sacred or holy is something the community collectively decides and teaches, and that people coming up in the community inherit. We use the language of social inheritance here. It's a social agreement. It's not an intrinsic property. And recognizing that this is a social agreement can restore human agency around this without dismissing meaning. That's the important point of tension here, right? We can acknowledge that these are constructs, and we can also acknowledge that they might be a meaningful construct to us. So that's a harder maneuver than it sounds like for some of us, because some of us were taught that they have to either be this or be that. And I'm contending that that's not the case. And then the fourth thing that we talked about is this notion, we kind of went from sacred objects to sacred texts, that they're powerful stories, but they're not literal history books. That the people who wrote these were storytellers, and their tools were myth and symbolism and narrative, and what they were doing was expressing meaning, and that's where the power is. So if we read these texts as literal, inerrant history, that can distort their actual purpose and enable harm, right? We're misusing the texts if we do that in terms of where they came from. We're not even honoring their genesis, so to speak, their beginning. So understanding them as story both preserves their value and provides the opportunity to resist the toxicity that can easily come from literal reading or this insistence that these texts are inerrant and authoritative. All right, so that's the summary. So I mentioned last week that my list has 14 points on it, and we've considered four. I just want to say, do not be afraid. I'm not going to try to exhaust my list. Also, it keeps growing. But I would like to take one more pass at a few items that I think might be especially relevant to many of the stories that I know, personal stories, both from within and beyond this community. And this first one is a bit painful for me personally because of the amount of time, money, and energy that I've put into it over the years. But I'm going to offer it anyway. So in the spirit of the ones we just looked at here, number five would be theology is not an open search for truth. Now, we might all recognize the word theology, but we haven't all studied it or perhaps even thought about what it is. And the word itself means the study of the nature of God and religious belief, or religious beliefs and theory when systematically developed. Right? So in my course of my education, among other courses that I took, was one called systematic theology. I loved the prof of that course, actually. He's one of the bright lights in my undergraduate educational history. Because one of the first things he said was in the class, and I was just like, you're my guy. He gets up in the first lecture and he says, if we had the perfect systematic theology, we wouldn't need God. Because we would have answered all the questions we're asking with our systematic theology. We'd be done. Like, it'd be a closed system. So he knew he was working inside of a closed system. He didn't last that long at that institution. Because that was jumping the traces, right? There are so many things about the definition that you see here that are intriguing, not the least of which, and this was cut and paste, okay, from Merriam-Webster, not the least of which is that when you look it up in a dictionary, the word God in the definition is capitalized. It's a proper noun. Proper nouns are the names of specific people, places, organizations, things, and ideas, and in English they are almost always capitalized. Quote, common nouns name general people, places, things, and ideas, and are not capitalized. So even the form of the word is saying something to us about right belief. It's legitimating religious notions, particular religious notions about what constitutes the divine. That's why it's a proper noun. That's not an objective fact, folks. That's a belief. That's a construct. But it's so potent historically and so common historically that the dictionary doesn't call it into question. But the dictionary is not a religious document formally, right? It's a common document to the culture. So that's kind of interesting in itself. All right. Now, where I want to go from there. When we study theology, at least from any vantage point that has to do with the Christian religion at this point in history on this continent, we're already beginning with a predetermined conclusion in general. All right, this is the way the system operates. And the predetermined condition that we're beginning with in those kinds of fields of study is that the Christian idea of God is true. And then as we lean into the study of theology, we become more specific, but that general idea doesn't go away. What it turns into is something like our specific or particular doctrine, whatever the our context is true. So it just gets narrower and narrower. Maybe you've never had the privilege. I was going to say, ever had a conversation or been in a room where somebody was arguing about whether Seventh-day Adventism was actually Christianity or not? I just think that's a brilliant example of this, right? It's a particular doctrine. This day is the Sabbath, not that day. And if you get into the fundamentalist side of that particular Christian religious group, you're going to discover that, like lots of other groups, they're like, yeah, the people who don't believe this about which day we should gather, those people aren't Christians. They need to get saved. They need to get their Sabbath squared away or whatever. And I'm not making fun of that, right? Like, if any of us grew up around religion, you can pick one that was like that in your context. And then what happens is we kind of do that kind of focus work is within those systems, the system starts to construct arguments to defend the doctrine. Okay, this is our particular belief within this bigger frame of belief, and here's our defense for it. And it's another not common word. But when we do that, when we're doing theology, we are doing a thing called apologetics, which means reasoned arguments and writing and justification of something, typically a theory or religious doctrine. We're doing apologetics when we do that, not inquiry. But it often gets framed as inquiry. And that kind of makes sense because often when it's being taught to people who haven't thought about that. So you can frame it as inquiry because it's new. But it's actually not inquiry. It's apologetics. It's defense. The reasoning inside of those systems is circular on purpose. It's not an accident. Those systems exist to defend the doctrine. So that's their starting and their ending point. That's their why. Okay? And that's not wrong, but it has some inherent hazard if we aren't aware of it. We can start to treat it like something that it isn't. The fact that it's circular and that it exists to defend the doctrine, that's one of the main reasons why it works so well from within the system, but it can sound and feel like utter nonsense from outside of the system. And that's why, and some of you have had this experience, you might have found yourself at some point in your life explaining to someone outside of your belief system what you believe, and they might say in response and be completely authentic in saying it, not trying to cause any harm or anything like that. They might say something like, that doesn't make any sense. Or you might have found yourself on the other side of a conversation like that where someone explained to you something that they believe. Let's pick one. The earth is flat, right? And you said, but that doesn't make any sense. And you meant it, and so did they, right? So this is not a bizarre experience. But in the religious system, when the listener says, that doesn't make any sense, far too often, the apologist, the defender of the doctrine, says something like, well, God's ways are higher than our ways, which also doesn't make any sense. It doesn't answer the question at all, right? It's dismissive. All right, moving along. One of the things that I was taught that has stuck with me, with some tweaks, is the idea that as humans, we're compelled to repeatedly try to answer a pretty standard set of questions. They go something like, who am I, where am I, what's wrong with where I am, what might be done to make what's wrong right? Or to put it away another way, what does it mean to be a human? What's the nature of this place where I am a human, of my world? What are the fundamental problems with this world? What's not functioning right or well about it? And is there any redress for whatever those problems are? I don't think it takes all that much imagination to connect a set of questions like that to some standard Christian doctrines, right? It's basically what Christianity or any religion does is try to answer those questions. Like that's the big task. So here's the dilemma for me. Time and again, history suggests that religion's answers to those big questions aren't quite cutting it. So an attendant question to that for me is something like, if some is good, if we take the working assumption that religion is generally good, which, by the way, is still the predominant cultural assumption underpinning most of the studies of religion, if we start there, we may not all share that, but if we start there, if the problem isn't religion, maybe the problem is how seriously we're taking religion. If it's inherently good, but it's not solving the problem, maybe if some is good, more would be better. Right? Does that logic kind of follow? What I'm going to say is that I think that might work if we find ourselves able to believe that whatever religion we've chosen is actually sourced directly from the divine, if it actually has an ultimately good frame or source. But, and here's that forest and trees dilemma again, if we step away from that idea, then we might be able to consider the possibility that religions are human inventions, that they're cultural artifacts. We make them. That's one of the reasons there's so many of them. I had this conversation with a friend of mine recently, who very, very thoughtful Christian, but deeply embedded in that belief system in a way that I wouldn't identify with. But he can talk, he can stand, he holds this stuff so beautifully. One of the reasons I really enjoy our long friendship. And he said, yeah, but Tim, don't you think there's like something there and it's a mystery, but when we come up with ideas, theological constructs, whatever, it's kind of like we're throwing a sheet over the mystery and the sheet lands there and we kind of get some kind of shape? And I was like, I like the image. I like the metaphor. And here's the question. How come when different people throw different sheets over it, we get different shapes? Let's talk about that. And that was a little moment. We had to both have a little more coffee on that one. Right? But that's what this feels like, right? We make them. And that's one of the reasons there's so many different shapes. Went to that in that metaphor, if we threw a sheet over it, right? Because not all the same people throw in the same sheet, if you will. Don't want to push this till it shatters, but there you go. If we look at the problem from that point of view, then I think we can start to consider the possibility that becoming more religious won't save us, because the human invention of religion reflects both our compassion and our cruelty. It reflects this range of human possibilities. That's one of the reasons why, for example, we have institutions like hospitals that have Saint whoever's name on them, and we also have residential schools that have Saint whoever's name on them. Intensifying religious commitment just intensifies what is already present in that frame, including the potential for fanaticism. So, from that vantage point at least, arguably, more religion is not the answer. Now, not least of all because we've been trained in either-or thinking by so many things in our that bigger cultural context I talked about. If we think that line of reasoning has some merit, if we think, well, okay, so more religion isn't the answer, then maybe if religion won't solve whatever's wrong with the world, maybe less religion is the answer. Right? So we're going to flip over to the opposite pole. But there's a problem with that as well, and it's one that we're all vulnerable to, and I think it's a problem that in some ways the table is uniquely vulnerable to. I'll get to that in a moment. The problem is that anti-religion can just as easily become its own form of dogmatism. And again, history has something to teach us here. Secular societies is a very broad brush, I realize, and we could find exceptions, I'm sure. But generally speaking, I think it's fair to say that secular societies that have oppressed religion have been no more humane than religious societies that have suppressed secularism. Let's talk about the Middle Ages, shall we? Our human capacity, who we are, to reference one of those central questions, our human capacity for harm or compassion doesn't depend on whether we have religious beliefs or not. It's not so much what we believe as how we hold what we believe that makes a difference. Hence my life-giving conversation with my deep-in-the-system friend. It's because of how he holds it. Which brings me back to how the table might be vulnerable. So we're unabashed about why we're here. We exist to make room to explore what we believe. I love that. I'm passionate about it. I've given, you know, no small part of some of the best years of my life to it, without regret. And also, I could weaponize that passion, that commitment. I could use that to judge whoever doesn't want to explore what they believe. Losers. Or whatever, right? That is akin, maybe it's not even akin, maybe it is, anti-religion functioning as a dogma, functioning as a belief system that judges all other belief systems and finds them wanting. So, from that vantage point at least, less religion isn't the answer either. Which brings us to 7 of the 14 items on my list. Nice. Oh, a perfect number in Hebrew tradition. But I, and quite possibly you as well, don't want to drag this out forever. So what I'm going to do is see if I can bring this around to some of the central ideas from that Deep End series on exploring religious trauma that it's set in, and just touch on those, and then we'll wrap this up for right now. So as we've considered, when we think about that series that this little duo of Talkie Bits is set in, religious trauma or religious trauma syndrome is most likely to show up in contexts where people are taught that they are inherently flawed and unsafe. Right, in terms of doctrines, those tend to show up around things like the doctrine of original sin and judgment. All right, those are kind of the big pieces. Being taught that the answer to the what's wrong with the world question is that we arrive in it sinful and inclined to rebellion, and that we can't do anything to save ourselves, that is grade A prime fertile soil for trauma to grow in. Doesn't mean that that will happen, but it lays the groundwork for it. And as we've touched on a couple of weeks ago, when someone experiences fear but has no permission or opportunity to express it or discharge it or seek safety from it, they're highly likely, some would say almost certain, to develop and experience complex PTSD, which shares many symptoms with RTS, with religious trauma syndrome. So this is not coincidental overlap, is the argument I'm making. And just a reminder, what we're doing here in our context is working at attenuating our radar, developing our awareness of belief systems that diminish agency, distort humanity, and rely on fear. Those are our three big themes that we're watching for. That's our working definition of systems that potentially cause harm. So, with that in view, I want to sort of flip the camera around from looking at or looking for the problems. There's a whole list of what doesn't work there, potentially, right? And look at this from a, I'm going to say, a more positive perspective. So let's think about this for a moment. If we can step away, even briefly, even as a thought exercise, from the idea that we're fatally flawed and fundamentally unsafe, so we can just stand back from those notions, if we reject those ideas and other sort of adjacent ideas to them, what might be an alternative to consider? That's not a little step away for some of us. All right, I understand that. I don't just understand it intellectually. This is ground I traverse. I'm going to do this in the shape of a story. The Greeks, those masters of memorable mythology, immortalized the story of a man who was perpetually unable to see the full reality of his circumstances. We call something, to this day in English language, we call something that is desirable but just out of reach tantalizing after his name. You've probably already surmised the character I'm talking about is Tantalus. As with many myths, there are many versions. But in the most enduring one, here's some of the broad strokes. In the most enduring version of this, generally speaking, his dad, Zeus, banishes him to the underworld as punishment. If you ever wondered, by the way, if Christian mythology had any connection to the Greek mythology, you can just stop right there. Dad banishes kid. Like, come on. You know, it's not a fuzzy link. Why he gets banished, there's so many versions, and a bunch of them are really, really gross. I'm not going to talk about them. You can look them up. They're easy to find. He gets banished to the underworld, and he finds himself in the underworld waiting in a pool of water while this tree dangles ripe fruit above his head. There's lots of art of this. The curse seems pretty benign, sort of a life imprisonment in paradise, right? But whenever he tries to pick the fruit, the branch moves away from him. Isn't magic amazing? Whenever he bends down to get a drink of water from this beautiful pool that he's standing in, the water recedes and he can't reach it. So he can never assuage his hunger. He can never quench his thirst. And the punishment, at first pass at the story, the punishment seems like that it's reaching for things that he desires but never could fully grasp. Okay, that sort of feels like the obvious read. If we think back to those big questions we referenced earlier, this allegory is actually a pretty good shot at a lot of the human condition, isn't it? Like, we are all constantly reaching for something more money, more happiness, more love, more security, more stuff, more something, more peace. And the Greeks believed that that characteristic was part of being a fallible mortal, and they used this story to illustrate the power of our never-ending desires. And of course, this is a central tenet, among other things, of the teachings of the Buddha, right? Is that it's our attachments, our desires, our attachment to our desires that cause so much of our suffering. Suffering might be inherent generally, but there's things we can do about the specifics inside of that by detaching from these desires. So it's an enduring theme. Again, at a quick pass, it seems like that's the essence of his curse, never-ending hunger and thirst. And if you think about never-ending hunger and thirst, it's visceral. It's powerful. I can hear some of your stomachs growling right now just thinking about that. Not really. And even if I could, I wouldn't say anything. But as we've often been trying to do in this series, let's stand back from the obvious reading for a moment. In this myth, Tantalus is already in hell. He's already dead. And as far as I know, dead people don't need food or water. What would have happened to Tantalus if he had just stopped reaching? Seen from that point of view, the curse is not that Tantalus is destined to spend forever reaching for what is always out of reach. The curse is that he's oblivious. He's unable even to consider the possibility that he doesn't need those things in the first place. Because otherwise he'd be like, huh. How many of you are familiar with the space cowboy series Firefly, the cult classic? Couple of nods. I mean, you might not like it. I'm prepared to go on record as saying it's in its own context brilliant and well worth the watch. But at one point there's a philosophical assassin who shows up and who eventually is, I don't want to spoil the show, but he doesn't win. But he finds himself drifting through the vacuum of space toward his inevitable end. And his observation, if I remember it correctly, is, well, here I am. And in some ways, I mention that because that's sort of what this can feel like when we step away from something that's so easily assumed to be the case. easily understood to be the given. We can find ourselves feeling like we're floating loose. And there's something deep inside of us, deep and primal inside of us, that does not like that. But what would have happened if Tantalus could have gone, I don't need that. I did, maybe, but I don't anymore. Because in this setting, that's not necessary. I don't have to keep trying to grasp that. Oh man, Zeus would have been so pissed if Tantalus was like, hey, thanks, Dad, I'm free. You know, that would have been, there's a twist in the story. All right. Well, depending on where you're at in your own exploration, what I'm going to suggest next might sound like anything from Shining Hope to Heresy that has its holder on the fast track to hell, assuming one believes in that idea. But I'm going to pose this as a question, okay? What happens to many of these toxic systems of belief if we choose to believe, here's the contrast, okay? If we choose to believe that we are capable of guiding our own spiritual life from the inside out. It doesn't just reduce the size of the lever, it takes the lever and it throws it out the window. It's Tantalus going, huh, nice tree, nice pond. What does this have to do with me exactly? Like, it's that kind of a shift. It's that substantial. To put it back into a question, what happens if we step away from the idea that it's our permanent condition to always be reaching for some version of salvation that we can never fully grasp without outside help? What happens to our thinking and our exploring if we do that? What if we entertain the possibility that the resources we need to guide our own spiritual life are already in us? Let's just consider this for a moment. What are the faculties that we need for a meaningful, ethical, and grounded life? This isn't an exhaustive list by any means, but I think it's a good starter. I would say that in order to live a meaningful, ethical, and grounded life, we need critical thinking. We need empathy. We need conscience. We need awareness of right and wrong. We need intuition. And we need imagination. I think those are the big pieces. We don't need to be told who we are or what we must believe. What we're looking for, if we're looking for a healthy spirituality rather than one that's toxic, maybe to put it into a sentence, we should be looking for spiritualities that empower our agency rather than undermining it. I appreciate in theory, I can't appreciate by experience because I'm a really privileged person. I can appreciate in theory that what I just said is easier to believe if you're someone who knows what it's like to have agency, and more difficult if that's not your experience. All right, I'm going to wrap this up. What I want to do is circle back to the sorts of ideas that we talked about that might make fertile ground for religious trauma and its related challenges and syndromes. I'm going to state an assumption of my own here. You don't need to share it. I'm going to start with the idea that we are fully capable of discerning what is true and ethical and life-giving as human beings. And I'm going to say that as individuals, we actually have the same capacity for that as any other human, including those that might have told us over the years that they know best what we should believe, that they are the one who should tell us what is true, ethical, and life-giving, and that's right belief. I'm going to say we all have the same capacity for that evaluation and that decision as any other human being. And when we step out of fear-based narratives and into our own agency, or as we've sort of plainly put it here at the table, when we think for ourselves, we can discover that the wisdom, the strength, and the clarity that we were seeking outside of ourselves were actually inside of us all along. Our starting point for a healthy spirituality is not you're broken and you can't be fixed and you can't trust anything inside of you that says different. That's not our starting point in that frame. What if, like Tantalus, the best thing that we can do is stop reaching for something we were told we had to have but actually don't need? Now, I want to be really careful with that idea. Don't want to spend a lot of time here because I said I was wrapping up and I meant it. There's a but, or at least an and. And we do need communities of shared belief. They're powerful, foundationally important to us as human beings. This is why we have a loneliness epidemic. It's because of the disintegration of those kind of collectives. Having said that, I hope that it's been implicit in the arguments I've been making that we can make them, those communities. There's many ways to make them. What we don't need to do is make them in a spirit of fear, being told by other people this is the only right way to make them. That's the heart of the argument. The fact that we're here at the table being a part of this means we're already participating in that logic, by the way. This is a community that at more than one point in its history was formally rejected by established religious constructs because they were like, you know, go for it, but you don't fit us. We don't fit you. And they were right. That doesn't make this wrong, but it sure makes it wrong for them. So, is that complicated? Yeah, I think it is. I also think it's really important. When we return to where we left off a couple of weeks ago, we'll be considering some ideas about what healing religious trauma and religious trauma syndrome might look like. I feel like there's been a lot of, here's the problem. I think that's important. I don't feel apologetic about it, and also not a space to stay in, but a place to start from. That's all easier to imagine if we choose to reclaim the inner authority that we may have been taught to distrust. Like so many things, that's easier to say than it is to do, so we're going to unpack it a bit at a time, and like all of our exploring in this context, we'll do it together. And until then, I wish and hope this for all of us when I say it every time. This is as close as you'll get in this context to hearing me pray out loud is when I say the word peace. Peace.